Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. We call this show Main Street because these microphones are our virtual Main Street across North Dakota. And, of course, those real ones where people cross the street and say hi to their friends and neighbors and talk about this or that, you know, share our news and opinions. And maybe today we're thinking, hey, it's April, it's spring, and it's also, did you know this, National Poetry Month. So today we'll start our show with Elizabeth Acevedo because she is a slam poetry rock star. Acevedo is a National Poetry Slam champion, a Beltway Grand Slam champion, and the 2016 Women of the World Poetry Slam representative for Washington, D.C., where she lives and works. Acevedo was recently in Vermilion, South Dakota for Poetry Month events and for conversations on race and civility. Today, we'll share her conversation with South Dakota Public Radio's Lori Walsh. They talk about folk tales, poetry, and thinking deeply about, as Acevedo puts it, what master your language serves.
I knew from a very young age that I wanted to tell stories. You know, I remember being maybe 4 or 5 and not yet being able to write, and my neighbor would have me talk to her plants, because she said it would help them grow. And I would make up all of these little songs that I would, like, sing to the plants and get so frustrated I couldn't remember them, right? And so I'm like, one day I'm going to know how to write, and I'm going to put these down, and then, like, I'll be able to say them out loud. And I think that was where it started, this, like, urge to make language permanent so that I could return to it. Yeah. And so even from when I was little, I wanted to tell stories, and I come from a long line of storytellers, not the most educated folks, right? My grandfather only had a third grade education, but could tell these long riddles. You know, and my mother tells these amazing stories about where she's from, and my dad has all of these jokes. So I come from folks who tell stories and have a long tradition of memorization. So since I was little.
What's the experience of sort of receiving that story as a kid? What's the context and how those stories were told? Around the dinner table, in a circle, like now we're going to tell a story? Mm-hmm. How was that space created?
It was very informal. Mm-hmm. I will say I didn't watch a lot of Disney movies growing up, right? We had The Little Mermaid and we had Lion King, and that was mm-hmm. all I saw growing up. Those were the two we had on repeat. And I didn't grow up with fairy tales. I grew up with my mother telling me about where she was from. And, like, you know, I love the story about her dropping, like, the package she went to pick off her mare. And I love the one about, like, her and her sister. She's one of 15. And so I loved listening to all of these stories. And that was what I grew up on, though. That was my Disney. And so it was very informal just based on where we were. Someone might launch into, like, a 30-minute story. And that was normal.
And where is your mother from?
Both my parents are from the Dominican Republic.
All right. So is there a mythology or a folktale from the Dominican Republic that was passed down, or were they all personal stories of what happened?
So a little bit of both. I think it's hard sometimes to tell, like, what's personal. Everyone right. has a personal attachment to myths, right?
Right.
But I didn't grow up thinking of them as mythology or of folktales. I grew up thinking of them as, like, my mother's stories. And it wasn't until I got much older and started really asking, like, what are the stories of this island? What are the stories of where we're from? And really started investigating that. And my last book is a collection thinking about all those stories that are being lost in some ways because right. no one tells them anymore. Everybody's moving to the city, and the city is a little bit less in tune or attached to folklore. You know, I'm really curious as to how stories are being passed down. And yeah. I think Dominicans tend to be very oral folks and tend to teach a lot of lessons using stories as points. And so that's still happening. But I don't know if it's necessarily the mythology and folklore that it used to be. It's more like personal examples.
Yeah. Did you take that with you into school, into college and beyond in a way that said, this is part of my identity, this is part of who I am? Are there times when those stories, you know, made a difference into how you interacted with others?
For sure. I mean, I think there are just what I consider cultural norms based off of these stories. Just like my mother didn't believe you should wash underwear in a washing machine. She thinks washing machines do not get it as clean.
Okay.
She grew up hand washing, and you hand wash. I remember going to undergrad, and I would hand wash my underwear and then put them on the shower rod, and my roommates were freaking out. They're like, what is this? And I thought that was totally normal because I'd been told my whole life, like, machines do not get things as clean as your hands do. Yeah. Your hands get things clean. right? And so this idea of what my hands could and could not do was something that I had never even considered might not be how other folks do it, right? And so that's a really simple example. But certainly, you know, the mythology of growing up with, like, a boogeyman, and we have our own kind of boogeyman, and, like, what happens in the dark. Or, you know, I grew up believing certain things about dreams and what dreams mean. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then folks are like, no, it's all psychology, and Freud says none of that is real, and it's all about, like, you know, sexual desire. And I'm pretty sure my mother told me that's not what this is, right? And so it's having to contextualize it all.
Who's your boogeyman?
El Cuco.
Mm-hmm. Tell me.
And El Cuco is just this figure that is dressed in, like, all black, and, like, he will come out if you're not a good kid. Uh-huh. You know? And so it's the exact same story of the boogeyman, but just that is a very specific name, and he has a very specific kind of kid he comes for. And we have these stories of, you know, La Ciguapa is what opens up my book, this woman who with backward-facing feet, mm-hmm. who would walk through the mountains, and people couldn't follow her because they couldn't tell what direction her feet were going in, but that she would lead people, you know, out of enslavement, mm-hmm. and she would lead men into, like, insanity. And right. So, like, if you came for her, she was like this almost feminist figure.
Yeah.
Right? You couldn't come for her without her being able to escape you. And so that idea was a really cool one growing up of, you know, how do you get out of certain situations and this right. mythological figure that did it.
And that moment where you're in college and your roommates say, what are you doing with your underwear? Is that can be a moment of, oh, I'm different. Mm-hmm. That could be a moment of, oh, you're different and your underwear is clearly dirty. Or it can be a moment of awareness and exchange from two different sort of backgrounds, storytelling backgrounds. What was that moment like for you?
Every moment was, there were so many of those moments, and it depended on what it was, right? That depending on how it was presented, there was shame, right? For someone, like, to say, like, you know, hand washing is so, there was almost this idea of, like, oh, it's primitive, or it's mm-hmm. like, we have machines now, why would you do that, right? And I was considering that, and I think I just struggled with, well, what does that mean? And now these are strangers. Maybe they shouldn't be looking at my underwear. And so that was what I was grappling with. Right. But I remember, you know, one of my roommates teaching me how she made spaghetti. And she, like, grabbed the spaghetti and throws it on the wall. She's like, well, now it's stuck. That's how you know it's done. And I'm like, did you just throw food at your wall? Like, that? Who throws food? At the right. So that was the moment where I'm like, oh, that does not make any sense. My mom would not throw food anywhere, right? And so I think it just depends. Every moment was a different kind of exchange. And it was a storytelling. It was, oh, this is how you do things.
Right.
Right? And in your head, you're like, you're judging on, like, will I do this? Won't I do this? Will I do this? You know, like, what do you adopt? What do you leave behind? Yeah. And so every moment was different.
Storytelling as a way to address issues of social injustice. You mentioned that. So let's elaborate on it. How does that fit in to, you know, a cultural action?
Right. I mean, I think a lot about how the stories we tell about people and repeat about people become truth. And really, I'm thinking about, like, how do we stereotype and how do we disrupt stereotypes? One of the examples I've been thinking a lot recently is, you know, there's been an opiate addiction problem in this country for many years. Right? I grew up in New York City where, like, I grew up seeing folks addicted to crack cocaine and knew what that was from a very young age. And knew that folks would get arrested for doing crack, and knew that they were left in the streets, and knew that they were not going to get help, right? And we had all these kind of derogatory terms to call them, and you did not want to be that. And now there's this new kind of push for, oh, well, heroin addicts, right? And that's not a drug abuse problem. Now it's the heroin epidemic.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now it's like we have to help, and it's because that demographic is very different than the demographic who was on crack. And what is the story that we tell about these different groups based off of where they're from and what they look like, although the addiction is very similar. Right. And so I think about that there's a violence to our language when we use it, you know, as a euphemism to help some and as a way to criminalize others. And so that was really what I was thinking about, what is the story we tell of people in neighborhoods, because that's also an urban versus suburban story and narrative. And just trying to process that and encouraging folks, what I was saying this morning is, you know, what master does your language serve? Hmm. That our language always is serving an idea or a cultural norm, And are you questioning who that master is and where you got this belief from? And that you should be, I think, right? And that if that master is not based in, like, radical empathy, there's a way in which you might be doing it wrong.
Right. Radical empathy. When you say that, what do you mean?
I mean just this ability to say, if we can only believe one narrative based off of what we may have heard at some point and can't step into what is this other person or this other group going through or believing in, or what is it that is driving them to live in the way that they do, although it may be different from how I live, right? Really stepping outside of yourself, I don't think you can cross cultural divides. I think this idea of social injustice will continue because we're always going to label those others, and they're crackheads and they're junkies and they're this and that and the third, and like we're just sick. Because the way that you use language doesn't allow you to empathize with them as who they are as people. Mm. And I really, you know, think about empathy all the time. And how do we teach, you know, and particularly when I work with young people, how do we teach them to be more human?
Right.
And be a part of that experience without just categorizing left and right.
Let's talk about language itself and how we sort of read and write. You know, we're talking about how we think and how we interact with each other. But when you interact with words on a page, you interact with your own pen and a piece of paper. Let's talk about that language and how to more deeply explore what those words mean. That's a strictly poetry thing, kind of.
Right. I think writing is a way of seeing. And sometimes I look at something and the words that come to mind as I'm trying to process it hit against each other. And there's something amazing that happens when I didn't think those two words would work in this moment, or I have to get that down because I don't know if I'm going to have this description again later. And I love that poetry is a story you can carry in your body, that you can memorize a poem, and it's this whole complete thing that now you have and that no one can take away, and you don't need a microphone and you don't need an audience, but you have this thing you can repeat if you need to and return to if you need to. It's like this little house in your body.
Right.
And that language, creating that, seems amazing to me, right? That we can build a whole world. And that's what I try to do. You know, they say the best poets, you know, have a strong economy of language. They know how to, like, make every word count in a way that I think other forms don't have quite that pithiness. And so I like thinking about, like, these are my tools, and they're, like, a short set, but they're huge also.
So don't throw the spaghetti at the wall, and don't throw away the, or don't throw the words up carelessly either.
Right.
A lot of thought goes into every poem. How do you revise? How do you edit something? Is that something you do out loud? Is that something you do on paper?
You know, I think it's funny because when you go to certain workshops, you're taught, like, you edit visually. How does the poem look on the page? How do you create an aesthetic norm on the page? And I grew up in a culture of listening. So I edit with my ear as well as with my sight, right? The poem wants to be beautiful on the page, but I really trust out loud. And because I perform so often, I think a poem will be done. And I'll read it to myself. Then I'll go out and perform it. And that's a workshop in and of itself because I realize what lines landed, what moment works well, what moment in my head isn't coming across in the language, and then have to go back and reconsider that. I think we edit and revise in multiple ways, and I like using all the tools at my disposal, so both visual and, auditory.
Yeah. Will you read something for us?
Yeah.
Tell us about this book.
So my chapbook is called Beast Girl and Other Origin Myths. It was a finalist for Yes Yes Chapbook Contest. Yes Yes is an amazing publisher outside of the West Coast. And it's a little bit thinking about all those myths, one of the different stories that we believe in. And I'm going to read a poem called Dominican Superstitions. So many of the superstitions I grew up with and that a lot of my friends grew up with. Dominican superstitions. For falling asleep, don't fall asleep with your knees up, or you'll invite a ghost to mount you. For ghosts, never ask them what they want. That's some American-ish. For ghosts that won't leave, use frankincense, conduct a rosary circle, lead them to a tree that guards gold. For nightmares, upon waking, speak your dreams into the air. The witnessing daylight will prevent them from coming true. For nightmares in which teeth crumble like aged cassava, someone you love has died. The teeth always know. For menstrual periods, don't touch any child not your own and don't wash your hair until you've bled for 5 days. For the evil eye, cross yourself and stay away from folks who would give a compliment but do not follow it with a blessing. For reading, don't do it while eating. For eating, don't do it while reading. For kitchens, open an oven or open a refrigerator, but heat and cold air should never tangle in the same body. For men, feed them well and feed them often. The fatter the man, the more likely he's too heavy to leave. For cheating, watch out if you skip a hoop while fastening your belt, because one too many times means someone else has been minding your man. For superstitions, treat them like salt. Scatter them before you leave, and let them impale themselves into the soles of your feet.
That's slam poet Elizabeth Acevedo reading from Beast Girl and Other Origin Myths. She was visiting with Lori Walsh, host of South Dakota Public Broadcasting's In the Moment. Next on Main Street, Bill Thomas.
Plains Art Museum in Fargo is hosting its 21st annual Spring Gala on Saturday, May 6th. The gala's theme is Garden Galore and will feature the dance band Heart and Soul, plus hors d'oeuvres and libations from a bouquet of caterers, wine tasting by Happy Harry's Bottle Shops, desserts by Nicole's Fine Pastry, and a silent auction. Ticket and art auction proceeds go toward increasing accessibility and art education. Tickets available at plainsart.org or by calling 701-551-6100.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by our director of radio, Bill Thomas, who also loves poetry and recently judged a competition.
Yes, I especially love poetry that's read out loud, like way more than just reading it on the page. And this contest is called Poetry Out Loud, and it is competitive poetry recitation. It's not poetry writing. They're reading poems written by well-known poets, but it's a high school contest. It's done in many states around the country, and in North Dakota, it is put on by the North Dakota Council on the Arts with support from the National Endowment for the Arts and the North Dakota Humanities Council and the Poetry Foundation, and students and schools around the state participate. I think they had 17 this year. And the winner goes to the Nationals.
And we've talked about this before. We've had you on because you've been a judge for Poetry Out Loud before. And it's always fun, as you say, to hear these young people read the poetry in their own voice, give it their own way of sharing it.
And it is really very entertaining. I mean, you know, you think of like student poetry recitations and you think of the kind of I wandered lonely as a cloud, da 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 da. And these are not like that at all. These are, you know, these are the champions from each of their schools, and the readings are really wonderful. And the last time I was on, I played excerpts from the finalist in the contest, and we're going to hear some more different people today. And I thought it'd be interesting first to hear two very different interpretations of a classic poem. It's a Longfellow poem. Very simple, and that the students are encouraged to do one shorter poem. They're encouraged to do one from before 1900, so Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And we'll hear first Connor Fitzgerald, who's from Lisbon High School, doing a version of this that's pretty straight ahead.
The Arrow and the Song by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. I shot an arrow into the air. It fell to earth I knew not where. For so swiftly it flew, the sight could not follow in its flight. I breathed a song into the air. It fell to earth I knew not where. For who has sight so keen and strong that it can follow the flight of song? Long, long afterward, in an oak, I found the arrow still unbroke. And the song from beginning to end I found again in the heart of a friend.
What a wonderful poem that is.
It is. No, it's a really nice poem, and, you know, it became kind of cliche of poetry reading, I guess, in a way, in certain circles. But it's really a wonderful poem. Now, it's done often at Poetry Out Loud, and it's usually done kind of like that, which is very good reading. But Jane Ricci, who's from Cavalier High School, she did it, and she decided to really do a different take on it. So let's listen to her. She's got a whole different way of doing it.
The Arrow and the Song by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. I shot an arrow into the air. It fell to the earth, I knew not where, for so swiftly it flew, the sight could not follow in its flight. I breathed the song into the air. It fell to the earth, I knew not where, for who has sight so keen and strong that it can follow the flight of song? Long, long afterward, in an oak, I found the arrow still unbroke, and the song from beginning to end, I found again in the heart of a friend.
You're right, Bill. It makes a big difference who reads the poem.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Poetry Out Loud, they don't encourage a lot of dramatics. They want you to do fairly straight readings, but that's, you know, it's kind of within the range of what she did there, and gives a whole different feel. I mean, it's interesting when you have, as often happens at this contest, different readers, different students doing the same poem. It's not unusual at all because they have a limited set to choose from for the competition in order to kind of keep it in some kind of regularity. And so you're often able to compare readings.
Well, it says something interesting about poetry too, in the sense that the poet has an inspiration that ends up with this particular poem. People read it and bring their own interpretation.
Yeah. Well, we had from one of the winners last time, we had a reading of a poem that I had not heard before, a very, I thought, well-written poem called Dear Reader. And this is a different person, Hannah Chen from Dakota Adventist Academy. She's reading that poem. She gave a really different reading to it. And this one starts quiet and really builds slowly. It's nice.
Dear Reader by Rita Mae Reese. You have forgotten it all. You have forgotten your name, where you lived, who you loved, why. I am simply your nurse. Terse and unlovely, I point to things and remind you what they are. Chair, book, daughter, soup. And when we are alone, I tell you what lies in each direction. This way is death. And this way, after a longer walk, is death. And that way is death. But you won't see it until it is right in front of you. Once, after your niece had been to visit you, and I said something about how you must love her, or she must love you, or something useless like that, you gripped my forearm in your terrible swift hand and said, "She is everything. You gave me a shake, everything to me." And then you fell back into the well, deep in the well of everything. And I stand at the edge and call, "Chair, book, daughter, soup."
It's something to hear a poem about aging and dementia from the perspective of a young person.
Really, nicely done. Good job, Hannah.
Well, Bill, we're going to have more from the 2017 Poetry Out Loud competition in Bismarck, and we'll also hear from some wonderful writers from the Dunn County Writers. We've talked with their leader, Elizabeth Strange, before, but time now for the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Andrew's Law is on its way to Governor Burgum. The law sets out rights and responsibilities when law enforcement uses confidential informants. It was named for Andrew Sedek, a student at the State College of Science in Wahpeton who was a drug informant. His body was found in the Red River, and his parents believe he was murdered.
Obviously, this is an emotional issue because of circumstances that have happened in our state over the last several years.
Dickinson Republican Senator Kelly Armstrong says the bill sets out the informant's rights while allowing law enforcement to continue to use an important tool in the fight against illegal drugs. Armstrong says the ways police discover the drugs is either through traffic stops or search warrants.
And the way search warrants are executed is typically by gaining information, not from law enforcement, but from people who are involved in this type of activity. And in North Dakota, that's far and away the most likely way you will get large weights of drugs off the street. So it's important that we do this, and this reform is needed, but it's also important to recognize that law enforcement has a tough job to do.
Under the bill, law enforcement can't promise an informant anything in terms of sentence reduction or commutation, but can say they will recommend lighter sentences to the judge. It also says if an informant is killed, a private agency will investigate it. It passed the Senate 44-1. It had earlier passed the House. Governor Burgum has signed a law intended to protect consumers from massive air ambulance bills. The law will regulate how insurance companies pay for life flight services in North Dakota and require hospitals to notify patients in non-emergency situations which air ambulance providers have contractual agreements with that patient's insurance company. North Dakota Insurance Commissioner John Gottfried says this has been something the insurance department has wanted to get done for some time. He says no one ever expects to need a life-saving trip to the hospital in a helicopter, and they definitely never expect that they will need to pay for it.
And let's be honest, I mean, when you're in a situation of when you need an air ambulance provider, you're likely either unconscious or, you know, your loved one's unconscious. And, you know, at no point is there going to be a time when the EMS comes in and says, well, we need to life flight your loved one to the closest hospital. Who's your provider? What do you want to do? I mean, those aren't decisions. Those aren't times for to have that conversation. Oftentimes the answer is, let's get them to the hospital as soon as we can. Let's fix it up and we'll deal with it later. And we're trying to make sure that when you're dealing with it later, it doesn't mean dealing with bankruptcy at the back end. Because nobody deserves that, especially, again, when you have health insurance and you've kind of done it the right way and you've been responsible.
Gottfried says over the past 4 years, the insurance department has received 28 complaints totaling $1.66 million in charges for air ambulance services. He says based on each of these complaints, each air ambulance ride can cost a consumer nearly $60,000. And the North Dakota House has approved a conference committee report making it a crime to knowingly cause bodily fluids to come in contact with an emergency responder in a healthcare facility. Representative Marvin Nelson says the latest amendment to the law illustrates the need to review the state's assault codes for the sake of consistency.
We have law enforcement officers who are covered. They're covered everywhere. But if you're out on a crime scene, and you throw feces on a law enforcement officer, you're committing a felony. And if you throw it on the fireman, you're not.
Representative Rick Becker says the law goes a bit too far.
These people are gorked out. They're on drugs. They're incoherent. They may be just defiant and oppositional and acting very poorly. So I mean, we're making criminals out of someone who may be on drugs and spits.
The final House vote was 76-16 in favor of the added protections. Violators could face up to 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with our director of radio, Bill Thomas, a lover of poetry, and he's sharing with us today some of the highlights for him from the 2017 Poetry Out Loud competition in Bismarck.
Yeah, there were so many good readings. You know, they have it at the Heritage Center in Bismarck. They have a really nice auditorium there if you haven't seen it, highly raked seats. And so you're looking down and the students all come in. They call it the procession of champions at the beginning, you know. And then each one comes up, and as you can hear, they give the name of the poem and the poet, and then they go ahead and read. And a first-time reader this year was Chaley American Horse from Solon High School, which is down near Standing Rock. And she reads a poem called Enough.
Enough by Suzanne Buffum. I am wearing dark glasses inside the house to match my dark mood. I have left all the sugar out of the pie. My rage is a kind of domestic rage. I learned it from my mother, who learned it from her mother before her, and so on. Surely the Greeks had a word for this. Now surely the Germans do. The more words a person knows to describe her private sufferings, the more distantly she can perceive them. I repeat the names of all the cities I've known and watch an ant drag its crooked shadow home. What does it mean to love the life we've been given, to act well the part that's been cast for us? Wind, light, fire, time. A train whistles through the far hills. One day, I plan to be writing it.
Wow. Wow. That was evocative.
Chaley, American Horse, reading that one. Yeah.
That was a lot of pretty big ideas for a young person, and yet she seemed to grasp them.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, wait till you hear the last poem we do this set. Well, I don't know. Maybe it's not that weird for a young person. It's kind of erotic, the last one,
okay.
You know, in a very non-explicit way. But as a matter of fact, it's about an automobile. But we'll get to that one soon. First, you know, one of the favorites of the Prairie Public crew that goes out there, because we record this for television as well as for radio, he was there last year, and he's from Elgin New Leipzig High School. His name is Austin Bolt. And he has such enthusiasm for the contest and picks – he and his teacher coach pick really interesting poems. And it's the TV crew, so they just want to do a documentary about him, you know. And he hasn't won either year. He hasn't been a winner or a finalist. But he always strikes us very strongly with his readings.
Dance Ruse by William Carlos Williams. If I, when my wife is sleeping, and the baby and Kathleen are sleeping, and the sun is aflame, white disk in the silken mist above the shining trees, if I, in my north room, dance naked grotesquely before my mirror, waving my shirt round my head, singing softly to myself, I am lonely, lonely, I was born to be lonely, I am best so. If I admire my arms, my face, my shoulders, flanks, buttocks, against the yellow drawn shades, who shall say I am not the happy genius of my household?
Okay. Dance Ruse, William Carlos Williams, not an easy poet.
No, no. They don't always pick easy ones for this one. Matter of fact, this next one, it's I guess you'd call it an allegory about an emotion, but it's an emotion portrayed not as this emotion is usually portrayed. And it's by a student from Northwood Public School. Her name is Mackenzie Holksevig.
Happiness by Jane Kenyon. There's just no accounting for happiness or the way it turns up like a prodigal who comes back to the dust at your feet, having squandered a fortune far away. And how can you not forgive? You make a feast in honor of what was lost, and take from its place the finest garment, which you saved for an occasion you could not imagine. And you weep night and day to know that you were not abandoned, that happiness saved its most extreme form for you alone. No, happiness is the uncle you never knew about, who flies a single-engine plane onto the grassy landing strip, hitchhikes into town, and inquires at every door until he finds you asleep mid-afternoon, as you so often are in the unmerciful hours of your despair. It comes to the monk in his cell. It comes to the woman sweeping the street with a birch broom. To the child whose mother has passed out from drink. It comes to the lover, to the dog chewing a sock, to the pusher, to the basket maker, to the clerk stacking cans of carrots in the night. It even comes to the boulder in the perpetual shade of pine barrens, to rain falling on the open sea, to the wine glass, weary of holding wine.
That's a look at happiness.
Okay. Well, now this next one's by Zach Howitt, who's from Northern Cass. He was the overall winner, and it is fairly characterized as racy, as you will hear.
Buick by Carl Shapiro. As a sloop with a sweep of immaculate wing on her delicate spine, and a keel as steel as a root that holds in the sea as she leans. Leaning and laughing, my warm-hearted beauty, you ride, you ride. You tack on the curves with parabola speed and a kiss of goodbye. Like a thoroughbred sloop, my new high-spirited spirit, my kiss. As my foot suggests that you leap in the air with your hips of a girl, my finger that praises your wheel and announces your voices of song, flouncing your skirts, you blueness of joy, you flirt of politeness, you leap, you intelligence, essence of wheelness with silvery nose, and your platinum clocks of excitement stir like the hairs of a fern. But how alien you are from the booming belts of your birth, and the smoke where you turned on the stinging lathes of Detroit and Lansing at night, and shrieked at the torch in your secret parts and the amorous tests. But now with your eyes that enter the future of roads, you forget. You are all instinct with your phosphorus glow and your streaking hair. And now, when we stop, it is not as the bird from the shell that I leave, or the leathery pilot who steps from his bird with a sneer of delight, and not as the ignorant beast do you squat and watch me depart, but with exquisite breathing you smile with satisfaction of love, and I touch you again as you tick in the silence and settle in sleep.
A little come hither with a Buick.
Zach Howitt.
Well, that was pretty. Thanks, Bill. It's always a pleasure to hear you talk about poetry out loud.
Great.
Coming up next, we'll have some prose readings from the Dunn County Writers.
I was 45, and he was 29. We met in a French medieval village called Bruniquel, and after 4 days of debate, I decided to go out with him. I couldn't resist him.
Join us for True Stories from Women Around the World. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Thursday at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and we're going to talk about a group of literature lovers in Dunn County. They call themselves the Dunn County Writers, and these amateur authors recently published a collection of short stories called Journeys, North Dakota's Badlands and Beyond. And the writers read a few stories at a publication party, Ashley.
They absolutely did. Like you said, the book Journeys, North Dakota Badlands and Beyond. It is a group of amateur writers and some people who write professionally, although not necessarily creative professionally. Sometimes they write, you know, for journalism outlets and what have you. An example here of one of the amateur writers, Ruth Granfer. She's from Dunn Center. She was born and raised in North Dakota, and she says that she hopes her writing makes people think. She shared a short story called Family Truck.
Wayne was a young child when his dad traded the truck in, but he was old enough to keep an eye on it. The 1935 Chevrolet was a work truck used to haul grain, hay, building materials, everything needed for life on a farm. It also hauled coal from both the Palton and Schollmeyer coal mines, located near Dunn Center, North Dakota. Wayne's dad used the truck when he worked with the Civilian Conservation Corps in the late 1930s to help build Lake Ilo. The lake, about 2 miles southwest of Dunn Center, was made by damming the convergence of Spring and Murphy Creeks. On rare occasion, the truck was a family truck. Wayne and his sisters would be gathered up. The youngest rode in front with Dad and Mom, and the older kids rode in back. In those days, trucks were made of wood and metal. The ride was bumpy and dusty as they traveled over gravel roads to visit family and friends. Sometime in the 1940s, Wayne's dad traded the truck in for a different vehicle. Wayne kept an eye on it. The truck was sold to a farmer. The farmer used the Chevrolet for many years before putting it out to pasture. There it sat, unused, on the prairie, with blowing snow, blowing dirt, and broken windows. The wind whistled through its body. The truck wasn't alone. Other old vehicles dotted the landscape, and a piece of farm equipment wasn't too far away. Wayne kept an eye on it. The 1950s, Wayne graduated from high school, from college, and got married. He kept an eye on it. The 1960s and 1970s, the children grew up. They graduated from high school and college. Wayne kept an eye on it. The 1980s, Wayne's children got married and grandchildren were born. Life was busy with church activities, school activities, sports, and music. Wayne kept an eye on it. The 1990s. Wayne received word about an upcoming auction. After 50 years, the family truck he knew as a child was going to be auctioned off. It was his chance to buy it, and he did. 2001, Wayne began to restore the truck. He got it running. He drove it in the Dunn Center 4th of July parade, his cousin in front, his sisters in back. In 2011, the fully restored 1935 truck got a fresh coat of dark green paint. Wayne, his sisters, and cousin once again drove it in the Dunn Center 4th of July parade. The family truck now keeps an eye on Wayne.
I love that story, just chronicling all those years and what a family truck can mean to, well, to a family, I
and
guess.
Hearing it in her own voice, that makes it pretty special. That was a well-told story.
It really was. Yeah, Granfer, I should mention, is a charter member of the Dunn County Writers. And the mission, if you're not familiar, of the Dunn County Writers is to capture the reflections of residents in transition, especially, they say, as folks deal with changes brought to the region by the Bakken oil. This group is reading from a recent publication party, their newest book, is called Journeys, North Dakota Badlands and Beyond. But this party, they also read from books called Winter Whispers, Holidays Past, Present, and Future, and A Pen for All Seasons.
Well, we heard Ruth Granfer, a charter member. Now, who's the next person we're going to hear from the Dunn County Writers?
We're going to hear from writer Terry Moore. He is originally from the West Coast, but he moved to the Bakken Oil Patch in search of work. And he wrote a piece called Visit the North.
It has been implied my whole life that north is synonymous with cold. It's funny how certain words can evoke images and stereotypes. For instance, I remember being on a field service repair call in Georgia back in the 1980s. I was explaining to the workers in the plant who had been using the computerized system to control their process just what had gone wrong. I said something akin to, the components on the communication card have gone south. Their reaction was immediate and profound, but that's another story. The North, it seems, is longing to gain a universally recognized location-oriented identity in the same vein as the East Coast, West Coast, Midwest, and South. Until now, there hasn't been a whole lot of interest in the North as a regional experience. The events of the Great Recession and the Bakken boom have changed that. Many people who had never considered the North as a destination have seen for themselves just what it has to offer. Uncluttered vistas, wind, wildlife, friendly people, agrarian lifestyles, and entertainment. It is a marking challenge, to be sure, but having the North become part of the American vernacular will serve this region well in the years to come. The people here will benefit from the attention it will bring.
So that's Terry Moore, and he's embracing the word North. And I can recall when they were debating in our state here whether we should drop that word and just go with Dakota.
Oh, yeah, I do remember that. I remember quite a few jokes on late-night television about that, frankly. Terry Moore, in his spare time, enjoys volunteering, writing. He is into music and FaceTiming with his grandkids. And he writes actually also on the opinion pages for a couple regional newspapers. And next up, we're going to hear from Jennifer Strange. She is a fifth generation Missouri River rat. That's what she calls herself. Raised in Sioux Falls, and she has bachelor's degrees in journalism and English, and she has a master of fine arts degree in creative writing, and she is also the director of the Dunn County Writers and was deeply affected by North Dakota's recent history, namely oil drilling in the Bakken. And here is a story that she calls An Offering for Mother Earth.
It is my third May in the Bakken oil patch. I am lonely and pent up in the apartment where I've been healing a fractured ankle for what seems like eternity. Foot and ankle on ice, raised above my heart, minimal mobility. My husband Terry has been working at least 70 hours a week for over 2 years. He is beyond spent, yet he never complains. I wonder how he feels about his wife, immobile, working from home, more or less completely dependent on him for life's financial necessities. I think how I would be festering with resentment if it were me out there hugging the hose that sucks up and expels about 600 barrels of toxic production water every day. I realize I can't stand it another minute. I need an escape, someplace I've never been before, someplace where my mind and body can breathe in something other than big oil. And so, this afternoon, I hobble down 3 flights of stairs, situate myself in the car, and drive 10 miles north of town. Then I head west to a part of the Killdeer Mountains I've never seen. Today, I am in search of renewal. I did not expect to return from my outing in search of redemption, crushed by the nonstop industry I found hidden between plateaus and tucked deep into the badlands of the High Plains. What are we doing to the good mother? Mother Earth births us and takes care of us and provides us a home. Now we frack her and crack her and drain her of precious fluids. I hope she may heal these deep wounds we inflict on her body, that her bones shall one day meld back together. I hope she will rise from whatever broken state we leave her in once we have rendered the riches we have made ourselves need. Drilling and filling our gas tanks with Mother Earth's blood is our modern communion, our sacrament that we will drive on. Noble drilling, black gold contracting. The pump jacks pray, kneel, and bow. They forever bow down to Mother Earth. They suckle her breast for the milk of modern conveniences, the nourishment of money, black gold, noble casing. Catholics light candles. Buddhists light candles. Black gold contractors light flares. The breath of Mother Earth is lit, constantly burning in the church of non-renewable resources, homage to the prophets she promises. Pheasants, squirrels, coyotes, porcupines, badgers, rabbits, deer, and birds are sacrificed on the Bakken's heart-dirt roads. Left to rot in the rain, dry in the sun, blow away in the wind. Altars that alter the landscape. How can I possibly atone for my responsibility, for my part, for my consumption? I cry my own salt water upon Mother Earth. Her prairie is parched. Today I went in search of renewal, and I return in search of redemption.
That's Jennifer Strange. She is the director of the Dunn County Writers, and she is a pro. She's not an amateur. She's a working journalist, and she's written stories and Kansas, Alaska, or Oregon, Washington, and of course, North Dakota.
These readings were all recorded last December at a publication party for the book Journeys, North Dakota, Badlands, and Beyond. It's just one of three books put out by the Dunn County Writers so far, and they are currently working on a fourth book to come out next December, and it'll be called North Dakota Notebook, Life on the High Plains. And again, that is due out this coming December. The writers group gets support from the Dunn County Historical Society, the High Plains Cultural Center, the Red River Writers Circle, and the North Dakota Humanities Council, as well as the City of Dickinson and a few other businesses, organizations, and individuals.
Very good. Dakota Date Book is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 18th. Door, North Dakota, predates the county it resides in, at least the current incarnation. McKenzie County was eliminated in 1891 for a lack of settlement before being recreated by the state legislature in 1905. Tiny Door, on the other hand, got its start 4 years earlier when its post office was established on this date in 1901. The town's namesake, Postmaster George Door, was an early settler in the area. The town has never been very big, but in its heyday, in the 30s, it had a general store, a school, a dance hall, bars, restaurants, even a hat-making shop. Its population hit about 50 in 1920, and again in 1960, but even those numbers might be ambitious. It's close upon the Montana border, in the small chunk of North Dakota that's on the west side of the Yellowstone River. The rich soil of the Yellowstone Valley supports sugar beet growing, but the isolated town still declined. It lost its zip code when the post office went south, literally, with mail service moving to Fairview, Montana. For decades, its population was just two people, a married couple who later gained new neighbors as workers arrived with the Bakken oil boom. A crude oil facility came to Door in 2012, and with it, so did the ubiquitous housing camps of the Bakken. For anyone driving north to Williston from Fairview, Door is on the way, but still easy to miss. There's just an elevator and a smattering of housing. Door didn't see quite the same dramatic growth as some of the other towns in McKenzie County, like Arnegard, Alexander, and of course Watford City. But all told, McKenzie County's population doubled since 2010, reaching more than 12,000 people. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Wednesday on Main Street, this year's community lecture from the College of Science and Mathematics at NDSU will feature Dr. David Schindler. Schindler is a professor of ecology in the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Alberta, and he's going to be talking about protecting freshwater quantity and quality in the 21st century. On Wednesday, Dr. Schindler will give us a preview. Also on Wednesday, we'll remember the flood of 1997, that devastating flood that inundated Grand Forks and threatened Fargo. We'll talk about it with flood veterans Mike Jacobs and Dave Thompson. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.